finally sold. I'm happy to say it was sold. They fixed it up and kept it very nice.
I am particularly happy to be appearing with you, before you, with my friend and man I admire, Henry Waxman, who's doing such an excellent job in this entire area. This is, as was mentioned in my biography, I haven't spent too much time on the West Coast. I neither went to UCLA USC. But I like it. I'm impressed by what I see. These are very tumultuous times for us back in Washington. The former California governor has taken swift charge of the country as president, and we're going through some very exciting episodes. And we're trying to get control of this inflation and interest rates. There are going to be cuts in the budget. There are going to be possibly some cuts in taxes. And the whole effect on the country of inflation and what's happening came home to me just a couple of days ago. I had a plumber in. And he was there for something just short of an hour because I timed him. And he presented me with what I thought was a rather substantial bill. So I mildly remonstrated with him and did say to him, you're making more per hour than I made when I was practicing law. He said, I know. I'm making more per hour than when I was practicing law. Now, I was impressed by the panel today, and as Henry mentioned, I thought, unless I missed something there, I felt that everybody wasn't so far apart as I expected them to be. And that's good, because this act, we approach, and when I use the word we, I'm speaking of the Environment and Public Works Committee. We're going to consider this entire act at the full committee. We're not going to have any subcommittee hearings on it. The Environment and Public Works Committee of the Senate, I believe, approaches this act with the feeling that we're in favor of it. If there are changes, we're prepared to listen to those changes. The burden of proof is on those who want the changes. We don't have a closed mind, but we start off with a decided tilt in favor of the act as it is. And we're going to need a lot of help. We want a constructive dialogue. It's not going to be any good for people to come before us and say the whole act's no good. And that's that, because that won't get very far. But certainly we can use constructive suggestions in how we might proceed. I think it's important to note, and I believe all the members of this committee recognize it, that the act has been successful in controlling air pollution. The total emissions from the regulated substances have dropped by 40% in the past decade since the Act has been operating. And in particular, the sulfur dioxide levels have decreased by over 65%, which is pretty good in any league. The carbon monoxide levels have decreased by 35%. Now, of course, there's been a cost associated with this, as was pointed out in the panel earlier. Some say, I heard the figure $20 billion bandied around. My figures were at $16 billion, but who's going to call about $4 billion between friends? But unquestionably, it's been expensive. But on the other side, it's had benefits. And how do you work out the cost-benefit ratio? Perhaps some of you have seen the study, and I'm not sure whether it's mentioned. I got to the panel a little late. The study by the professors at Harvard and MIT entitled Health Effects of Fossil Fuel Burning. They come to the startling conclusion of this in this two-year study that 53,000 Americans die each year from the effects of air pollution. And then the authors assigned a value of $1 million for each life and computed a cost-benefit analysis of pollution control. Now, somebody here can argue that life wasn't worth $1 million, but let's not get into that. In any event, it's a very, very expensive. Working on the figures they had, the cost of air pollution has been expensive. Now, how are we going to balance off these both sides of the issue as we deal with the act? That's the difficult part. The chairman of our committee, Senator Bob Stafford from Vermont, has indicated he would like to complete the reauthorization process by mid-September. Now, that's an ambitious schedule, as Henry, Congressman Waxman indicated that we're all going to have trouble reaching any schedule like that. We're going to have For openers, we're going to have two or three days hearings in early April, and of course we'll have more hearings later on. There are lots of people that want to be heard, and possibly we'll have hearings around other parts of the country. What are some of the issues we'll be considering? We'll be considering the impact of the Act on synthetic fuels development. We'll be considering the long-range transportation of air pollutants. We'll be considering the prevention of significant deterioration, PSD, the impact of the emission standards on the auto industry, the impact of the law's requirements on other industries, such as the steel industry. Now, the framework I think that we'll be using to a considerable extent will be the findings of the National Air Quality Commission, which just reported last Monday. That was a $5.5 million study that took 2.5 years, and that report, I believe, will have a significant effect on our deliberations. Now, I've made some conclusions on the recommendations they've made. Those conclusions obviously are subject to change based on what we hear from the witnesses. I always remember what they said about Bob McNamara when he was Secretary of Defense, that he'd prepare his trip report before he'd go to Vietnam. Well, I don't think that's the very best way to proceed, so I want any witness to know that I have made up my mind that one member of the committee, and I'm open to persuasion. But I'd like to raise with you some of the points that were made in that report. Henry's touched on some of them already. The air quality standards. The air quality standards, which say that primary health standards must be set without regard for compliance costs or availability of control technology, I believe in. I think that's the right way to proceed. There's been controversy over the validity of the standards, and business and industry, and we've heard that today in some of the discussion, have charged that EPA used questionable data and that it's impossible to arrive at anything specific. That, of course, can obviously be argued about, but the Commission concluded that EPA should continue to set the quality standards without regard to costs. I believe in that. The state implementation plans. The state plans were due by July 1st, 1979, but very few were approved. Some western states have gotten theirs in, Wyoming, Colorado, Oregon, so forth, some 20 states in all. Plans have already been approved, and 26 have been partially approved. EPA, as you know, is empowered to invoke sanctions against a state with unapproved plans. And the Commission recommended against applying sanctions with unapproved state implementation plans, but wanted it done on a sliding scale linked to the amount of progress that has taken place. That seems to make sense to me. I think the sliding scale has some merit. Briefly on non-attainment. Closely related to the issue above are the deadlines for which states have to meet the national standards. Henry touched on this, and this has been a controversial subject, the question of deadlines. In 1977, the chairman of our committee, subcommittee at that time, Senator Muskie, said as follows: if the firm's statutory deadlines are nullified, every pollution control measure imposed by EPA or a state would be held hostage to legal challenges and possible reversal on ground of judicially perceived reasonableness. In other words, there'd be all kinds of arguments would be able to be presented. There's still the argument about the deadlines. I agree with the Muskie viewpoint. I think that the absence of deadlines means a tremendous delay in compliance. Now, the Commission also recommended the elimination of the lowest achievable emission rate technology in regions that don't comply. Instead, the best available control technology should apply in both clean and dirty air regions. But as you know, the Commission also said that at no time should these requirements be less rigorous than the non-source performance standards. Now, the Commission based its recommendations on the finding that states generally have made the lowest achievable emission rates equal to the new source standards. Critics complain that the only reason the Commission proposed the elimination of the lowest achievable rate is that most states have failed to impose it during the last 3 years. This program of lowest achievable standards can also require major new industries and expanding industries in areas of non-compliance to offset the non-pollution, to offset the new pollution they will produce. In other words, we get into the whole offset business. The Commission recommended keeping the offset program intact, but said the states rather than industries should take over the responsibility for finding the offsets. I must say I have trouble with the whole offset provisions, and that may be kind of a radical statement coming from an area that is a non-attainment area, and obviously I'm anxious that we not increase, the state I'm in is not an attainment state, but the offset provision seems to me to be a very cumbersome one. Now PSDs, prevention of significant deterioration. That's one that received, of course, considerable discussion today. That has been extremely difficult for everybody involved. Now, the critics have charged that the policy has made new development, especially energy development, impossible in clean air areas. The Commission did not find that. The Commission specifically said there's no case that they could locate where PSD has prevented industrial or energy development. And that's rather a significant finding, I think. The Commission, of course, recommended eliminating Class 3 and restricting Class 2 areas. Coming from my section of the country, which has not yet met ozone standards, partially because we're downwind from the rest of the nation, I must say I'm concerned about the elimination of the Class 2 and Class 3 categories. As someone mentioned today, that might well promote a movement from our section of the country out to other sections that have the clean air and lead to this massive relocation of urban industry, something that I am not encouraging. Also, just speaking as an American, it seems to me it raises the level of dirty air in the country, and I don't think we should be for that. The auto industry. Emission standards. The auto industry contends, of course, that the emission standards requirements could be eased without creating a public health risk. The Commission recommended keeping the basic standards for hydrocarbons and nitrogen oxides, but easing the rules on carbon monoxide. I'd be open to persuasion on that. I must say, I don't know enough about it. It does seem to me that they've met the carbon monoxide standards already. They are at the 3.4 grams per mile. The Commission recommended raising it to 7 grams per mile and say there'll be a saving of $30 to $60 per vehicle and improve fuel economy of 1%, which is pretty significant. A 1% improvement in fuel economy in this nation is substantial. And the Commission further said that raising these standards on the carbon monoxide would not affect air quality in any significant manner. This is a difficult decision. Again, it seems to me if we've already developed the technology, if we're already at that standard, I can't quite see why we should go backwards. But again, we'll listen to the testimony that comes from the automobile manufacturers. Finally, I'd just like to say this. There's a feeling abroad in the nation that the environmental movement is in retreat. That the last election on November 1st sounded the tocsin that we don't want any more to do with these environmental pointy heads, and that we want to get busy with jobs and things that count. Well, I don't interpret the last election that way at all. I think that the last election was decided on economic matters. It was a rejection to a great degree of the policies that President Carter had followed. All across the country, you can find votes that were taken at the same time that this administration was elected that reflected the people's concern for the environment. Let me just give you one illustration. On the ballot in my state on November 1st were six statewide bond issues. Three of them were rejected. The one that passed with the largest majority of any of those bond issues was the largest bond issue in the history of our state, which was for the state to pay for the repairs and fixing of a single city's wastewater treatment plant because that plant was polluting Narragansett Bay, our largest bay, a very significant environmental attraction to our state. And even though this money that the people were voting on went to one city to help one sewage plant in that city, the voters in 36 of the 39 communities in our state voted for it, even though in their own cities they were paying for their own sewage treatment plants. In California here, I understand you approved a bond issue on November 4th for nearly $500 million for the acquisition of parks. And in Oregon, the voters went on record to oppose any further construction of nuclear power plants until a solution to nuclear waste disposal could be found. So I don't think that we should consider those who are interested in environmental matters considered that we better head for a bomb shelter and lay low for a while. I think there's just as much interest in this nation in cleaning up the air and cleaning up the water and maintaining all the environmental progress that has been made in the past. And as we consider this extremely complicated measure, the Clean Air Act, we're going to need all the advice and support and constructive suggestions that we can possibly receive. And I thought that panel today set a high standard, and we look forward to the testimony and support of all who are interested, including many here, to help us in these difficult times ahead. Thank you very much.